I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. I'm with D.T. Max, New Yorker staff writer, especially biographer of the late David Foster Wallace, in a book called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. David Foster Wallace, author of Infinite Jest and many other pieces, lives larger than ever in literary life in America. Not only chronicler of the anxieties, the addictions, the weirdness of our times, but an embodiment in a certain way. D.T. Max, I interviewed David Foster Wallace on Infinite Jest when it first came out and thought of him as an Illinois writer. Your biography recasts him in a certain funny way as a child of Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, halfway houses, universities, friends, famous friends like Mary Carr, right where we're speaking. Who was he, after all? And what was the mark of his writing that made you think this is worth the serious biography you've given him?
Well, I think there's really two very different questions here. David was a Midwestern, really a child of Midwestern academics, but as somebody who was so exceptionally bright and also exceptionally focused on the academic life, you know, both his parents were academics. He never thought of being a writer who sort of lived in a bungalow. He always thought he'd be a writer who taught. You know, Boston was a natural place for him to gravitate to. And so he's here actually a couple of times in his life, but most importantly, it's where he writes Infinite Jest. I mean, most of Infinite Jest is really begun and even carried beyond that point. Well, he's either living in Somerville when he's at a halfway house in Brighton, and later on when he lives in a series of apartments. The last one was in Arlington before he eventually moves to Syracuse. To answer the second question, you know, I think David is the author of his time who has the sort of the fairest chance to be read 50 years from now. I mean, I think that's a prediction that in some ways really doesn't have a ton of meaning, because who knows what the culture will be 50 years from now. But assuming some sort of continuity of culture, I really feel that the way David sort of touched the themes of the 1990s, themes of addiction and excessive entertainment in American culture, have become even more outstanding, more relevant to most of us. And when you reread Infinite Jest today, one of the miracles, it's really a novel that's fundamentally about television and video, but you read it today and you think you're reading a novel about the internet.
What is the mark of those Boston neighborhoods, Arlington, Brighton, Cambridge, Somerville?
You know, I think there's a way you can consider Infinite Jest a Boston novel. In the same way that you can consider Edith Wharton to be a New York novelist, there's a quality of Boston that I think suffuses the writing, quality of this kind of combination of town and gown that you find deeply woven into Infinite Jest, you know, where even at the halfway house, there's sort of the hyper-educated people who, as he writes, you know, try to erect some sort of denial-type fortification with intellectualists showing off. You know, those are one set of characters, and then there are really the sort of down-and-out, the townie characters who come from poor neighborhoods around Boston and in some ways really carry the novel forward, who have, especially in David's conception, these are really people who have a deeper understanding of what matters than the more intellectualish people have. So, you know, it's almost the Eloys and the Morlocks, and I think David had grown up very much an Eloy. And by the time he gets to Boston, he's been an addict and he's, I think, 27 years old. He's beginning to look elsewhere for his wisdom. He feels like, you know, the Eloys don't have wisdom, and he's been unable to, you know, get out of his own head. I mean, the decisions he's making, there's a slogan in 12-step, you know, your best thinking got you here. And I think that's a slogan he took very much to heart. And as a result, you know, when he looked around for the characters he would create in Infinite Jest, I think he was very attracted to people who had less higher education, especially people in, you know, in his recovery group, the group called Crocodiles, you know, who were the sort of ordinary blue-collar workers who had been, you know, sober for 30 years. And, you know, he saw in them a wisdom that he very much wanted and didn't know how to get. Infinite Jest itself also has, you know, wonderful kind of raffish characters, almost the equivalent of sort of Damon Runyon's Broadway. I mean, it has criminal Boston, it has, you know, drug addicted Boston, it has, you know, bunco man Boston. I mean, it's got lots of different Bostons in it. And I think David wasn't a guy who had a massive experience of the world. I think he mostly got those stories from other people. You know, part of what he found, I think, exciting about the Boston that he fell into through recovery and through his halfway house was he met a Boston he would never have met otherwise.
He ripped a lot of those meetings off in a certain way. And I know maybe it's from you that he heard back, or there were people who resented what he had done with their words.
Well, I think the whole subject's very fraught. You know, when you're in recovery meetings and there's a guarantee of anonymity, people, I think, often feel as if somebody has taken their stories. But I think what David would probably very capably have argued is it's one thing to hear a story. It's another thing to turn that story into literature. You know, he was always a writer. I mean, there was no moment, even sort of in the depths of his voyage to the darkness of the night, there's no moment where David isn't 100% a writer. I mean, he always had his notebook with him. It's almost like being a cop and having a badge. Never, I think, for a moment did he think that he was just a person experiencing these things. I think he always felt that it was his job to sort of transmute them, you know, to turn them into some sort of gold.
Which of those stories made a particular mark on you? Specifically the yarns and the languages, the voices that he pulled out of those recovery meetings.
Poor Tony, I think, is a terrific character. You know, this drug addict and sort of small-time con man. Well, they go and they try and buy heroin in Chinatown, and because of a previous sort of disastrous rip-off type situation, the heroin is cut with, I forget if it's cut with Comet or something like that, and one of the addicts dies. You know, they shoot up on a grate, I think, by the Boston Public Library, and one of the addicts dies because, you know, it's cut with Comet or something. I mean, they're very Boston moments. There's just this quality, you know. I believe poor Tony's on the Orange Line when his bowels give out. You know, he's done so many drugs that at that point, you know, he just completely falls apart. And people, if I'm remembering right, they go from one subway car to another to get away from him. And you know that David was in these places and that he had real personal memories of what it was like. It's funny, you know, in the end, I don't think he liked Boston very much. He writes a letter, I forget to whom, where he says he's grateful to get out of this soot-infested city. And you can take that lots of different ways. I mean, David lived a very, very humble life in Boston. I mean, not originally. When he first comes to Boston, to the Boston area, he moves into Somerville with his old college roommate, Mark Costello. And the idea is that he's going to recreate the fun of their rooming group at Amherst. You know, they're only 26, 27, but a lot's gone on in their lives since they were undergraduates. And, you know, David enrolls as a philosophy graduate student at Harvard, and he only lasts about 8 weeks. So from Somerville, David is quickly deposited at McLean, which is in Belmont, where he dries out. And from there, he goes to this halfway house, which is in Brighton. And from there, he goes to sort of a quarterway house around the corner. And then eventually, he moves into Arlington on Mass Ave, a place I've actually been to see, to a very sort of humble two-story clapboard house where they had the top floor, I think. And, you know, there he writes in this very, very small, dark room. He writes much of Infinite Jest. And actually, it's quite wonderful that these very ordinary places spurred so much in David's imagination, and really is a work of kind of miraculous creativity that you know. Also, he's teaching at Emerson College during much of this time, so he's got a kind of adjunct. He's sort of one of the lowest of the low. He's like a, you know, Emerson had a pool of adjunct professors, but they were really just, you know, hired guns, and the school, I don't think, cared much about them. And, you know, they didn't feel very invested in the school. And during this period, you know, where David's living the life of a kind of, not even an academic gypsy, and he's like, he's just barely getting by. He's like one step above, you know, being the kind of guy who finds books in dumpsters and brings them to, you know, used bookstores. I mean, he's got no money. That's when he's writing Infinite Jest. I mean, it's a funny time for David, because even though I'm describing him as the guy who's like barely out of the gutter, it's also the same time when the Review of Contemporary Fiction devotes, you know, a third of an issue to David. I mean, how strange that must have been. You know, he's living in this walk-up with his other graduate of a 12-step program, and basically it's all about sobriety. And yet, I mean, David's not sure he'll ever be published again, but this guy comes to his house and they go over, you know, this endless interview that's become kind of the linchpin of David Foster Wallace studies. This interview that appears in Review of Contemporary Fiction is just an absolutely brilliant interview. And it's very hard to imagine David, you know, in this situation declaring, as he does in the interview, that fiction's about what it is to be a fucking human being. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about a guy who, you know, was really on the balls of his ass, and yet somehow he's always aware on some level that he has, you know, that he's working on this book, and that this book, he doesn't know if it's going to be successful, he doesn't know if it's going to get a publisher. He's really living off the fumes of his previous literary reputation in one way, but in the other way, he's totally forward-looking, totally thinking about mm-hmm. the book he's got piled around his bed, all those handwritten pages.
I can still see him in our studio. I can imagine headband around his head. I can almost imagine tennis wristbands, too. He was very friendly. He was very humble, very nice. But again, I was thinking of his Midwestern era. I wish I'd asked him for the David Foster Wallace Guide to Greater Boston. Any idea what he would have said?
You know, the David you saw, who comes back only a few years after he left Boston, he goes to Syracuse, and then he gets rescued by a tenure-track offer from Illinois State University in Bloomington Normal. And it's kind of amazing because, you know, he really hadn't taught for years, and you didn't have to be a genius to see that there was this huge hole in his resume. I mean, where had he been for the last 4 years? But so when David comes back and sees you, you know, I think he's very aware when he comes back to Boston, you know, of what he had experienced here. He also has this tumultuous relationship with Mary Carr that begins in Boston. Boston's where he tries to buy a gun, planning to kill Mary Carr's husband, for instance. I mean, he must have had very bittersweet feelings when he came back. And I have a lot of David's correspondence, but there's no mention anywhere in the correspondence that David wishes he was back in Boston. I think it was, these were crucible years for him. I think they're years where he was able to create the remarkable Infinite Jest, but I think probably looking back on them, he must have felt to himself like it was amazing that he had survived. You know, I mean, imagine this, he's only barely sober. He has gone from being, you know, a storied writer and then a top-notch graduate philosophy student, you know, to being a guy who, you know, is hanging out with addicts and convicts in the space of just a year or so. And then it's from there he has to sort of dig his way back out, and he digs his way back out really through the strength of Infinite Jest. I mean, he doesn't have much on his mind besides Infinite Jest and getting sober during the years, and also perhaps marrying Mary Carr. But, you know, he's in a very, it's the kind of situation, I think, you know, he comes back about a year before Infinite Jest is published. He comes back one time to a panel Sven Burkers has invited him to. Sven Burkers, the wonderful critic who had sort of first discovered David's voice in a way, and first one to really value David's voice. And he comes back and he does a panel in Arlington on the future of literature. And during that panel, actually, one of the interesting things is he's gone on such a long intellectual voyage that it seems like Sven, John Franzen's also on the panel, and it seems like, you know, they talked to like 50 people, which is funny today because, you know, were David alive, he and John would pack a stadium practically. Anyway, he talks about his early stories, and it's clear that Sven likes David's early stories at this point more than David does, mm-hmm. which I think is really symbolic of how much Infinite Jest is really a dividing line in David's life. Like, it really, you know, there's a life before he wrote Infinite Jest and the life after he wrote Infinite Jest. So the fellow who comes into your studio, I think, is a very, very different person, somebody who's, as you say, very humble. Very Midwest is an interesting observation. I think he had in some way, one thing David did to protect himself as a person was to sort of minimize his sort of East Coast connections. I don't think he mistook Boston for New York. I mean, New York was a place he had a fierce allergy to. I don't think he felt that way about Boston. I just think he felt it had been the hardest time of his life. And as far as I know, I don't know that he ever came back. Maybe he came back on book tours. I think he did actually once read at the Boston Public Library. And now that you mention it, another funny David moment in Boston is he didn't like literary awards, but the Harvard Lampoon, he was very fond of the Harvard Lampoon because he had tried to do something very similar at Amherst in the form of Sabrina, the literary magazine. So the Harvard Lampoon invites him back to be the author of the millennium or something like that, author of the century, author of the eon. And he accepts it only after being assured that, you know, it isn't a real award. And he comes back and he has a terrific time at the Lampoon, remains friends with the Lampoon president of that day, who's now the showrunner for Parks and Recreation. And so, you know, it's too simple to say that David had never looked back. I mean, I think he probably took the pieces of Boston that he felt better about. But that's not really matter for us in the sense that I think he changes how you see Boston. What he captured brilliantly was that period before money sort of flowed back into Boston, when it was a pretty threadbare city. Well, he lives for a time in Somerville in this area that was called Little Portugal, which I don't know Boston that well, but I imagine today is a fairly, you know, yuppie enclave. But
halfway.
Well, then it was, you know, very much a kind of place like a hip young man like David without much money would live. I mean, it was making a little bit of a statement. But I think, you know, the city on the whole, like most cities, like, you know, has gotten richer and gotten a little bit of a new coat of paint. And the city that David captures very well, I feel, is that sort of, you know, late 80s Boston, you know, in all its sort of raffishness. He's especially good, but because he was so involved with his 12-step program with recovery, you know, he really meets a Boston that geographically probably wasn't going to have bumped into him any other way. And he's brilliant. Infinite Jest is beautiful at capturing that. You know, one of the letters that I quote in Every Love Story is a Ghost Story is that he refers to his sponsor as a motorhead from the South Shore. And then he meets the character who becomes Don Gately, and, you know, he grew up on the North Shore and was a Demerol addict and all that stuff about breaking into houses that's at the beginning of Infinite Jest. He learned all that, you know, I'm sure from Big Craig, the model for Don Gately. So his Boston became a kind of dream Boston because of his recovery program, where he met different kinds of people much faster than you normally would. And I think it was a huge gift to his book.
You've brought him back in wonderful ways.
Well, thank you for having me on. I mean, his relationship to Boston, I really feel, is something that bears more scrutiny and more attention and more affection, because I think people usually think of Infinite Jest as a novel that's sort of set in a kind of nowhere of America, but actually it's very, very deeply and distinctly set in Boston.
Thank you.